Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Big Brother is watching you.
That's right.
Not the CBS reality show, folks. I'm referring to the book by George Orwell.
1984. Just read 1984.
This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Andy is still exploring the world of music and adventure out there, wherever he might be. Don, how you doing, man? You ready to get into some 80s nostalgia?
Yes. I brought my pencil.
I hope it's not loaded. Yeah, so here we are. People that love talking about albums. So that's what we're going to do today. We've got a great show. We're each going to be picking an album that was on the top 10 of 1984. So as decided by Billboard. We will also be answering a deep question from Don. We're going to have some shout outs to some albums and album related items we're digging. And then we're going to spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what the topic will be next time. This week, it's all about 1984.
1984. That's what I'm talking about.
1984 was a memorable year. The top grossing films were Gremlins, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Good year, right?
Lucky kids.
The USA hosted the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles while the Eastern Bloc countries boycotted. Of course, the USA just dominated.
I boycotted also because it interrupted my TV viewing. That's during right. The summer.
Apple launched the first Macintosh computer. Do you remember that Super Bowl commercial that actually had like the 1984 theme?
Yeah.
The Cosby Show debuted, as well as Miami Vice, two big pop cultural shows. But today, we will both present an album from Billboard's list of the top 10 albums of 1984.
Yeah, so these shows are always interesting because we have very little control. We have a short list, and it turns out we've already covered many of them. Yeah. So Andy's lucky he's not here because he would have been stuck with who knows what.
Yeah,
we'll try and decide that as we go through. So why don't we just run through the top 10 quickly, and then we'll get to our picks.
Okay. Well, number 10 was Duran Duran's Seven and the Ragged Tiger. I mean, it was an interesting album, but, you know, not quite as, you know, complete as Rio in the first album.
It had the Reflex stuff.
Right. But, of course, the hit was the remix, the Nile Rodgers remix to the Reflex. So people were disappointed when they would buy the album and it was different. But still solid album. The soundtrack to Footloose.
Right? That's probably what Andy would have been stuck with.
I love that. Of course, that had Kenny Loggins, you know, with Footloose. And then Denise Williams, Let's Hear It for the Boy.
Right. Which I liked that song because in the video, it showed some kids breakdancing. And at that time, if I saw kids breakdancing in anything, it meant it was good, even if it wasn't.
Number eight was Synchronicity by The Police, the final album, which we just covered a couple episodes ago on 258. Do we need to say more about that? We could probably just... Okay. Number seven was ZZ Top Eliminator.
That would have been good to talk about, yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in checking that one out. You know, kind of, I think, maybe a shinier version of their Southern rock. Had the hits Legs and Sharp Dressed Man. And then six and five, we'll skip for now.
Psst, those are our picks. But then we had number four, Billy Joel and Innocent Man, which we discussed on episode 114. I think it was just me and Andy at that time.
I remember listening, though.
He did not like that album. I loved it as a kid. A nostalgic tribute to 50s and 60s pop featuring hits like Uptown Girl and The Longest Time. Lionel Richie, Can't Slow Down from episode 159. Polished mix of R&B that confirmed Richie's solo superstar status with All Night Long and
Hello.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a big time album. I loved that at the time as well. I was a little kid. Huey Lewis in the News Sports, episode 129. Rock album
boom, boom,
packed with
boom,
infectious boom, radio boom, friendly boom. Hits. That's right. Hard Rock and Roll, I Want a New Drug. But they were just like a bar band that had horns and... Yeah. Fun. They were just having fun, and I think that was that really fit in well in this period of the 80s. And of course, number one was Michael Jackson's Thriller, which we covered on episode 210. highest selling album of all time, blending pop, rock, R&B, Billie Jean, Beat It, Thriller, Human Nature. But that album came out in 1982, so it just dominated for several years.
Yeah, and a bunch of these albums in a normal year probably would have spent more time at number one.
Yep, Michael Jackson ruined it for everybody. Yep. All right, well, why don't we get into our picks?
You choose me?
Well, coming in at number five, it's Culture Club with Color by Numbers, actually released in October 1983. It's their second album. They're a British band formed in London in 1981, featuring singer Boy George, born George Allen O'Dowd. Guitarist Roy Hay, bassist Mike Craig, and drummer John Moss. So actually, I didn't know this. I guess they realized they had an Irish gay man as the lead singer, a black Briton on bass, a blonde Englishman on guitar, and keyboards, and a Jewish drummer. So that's they said, hey, we're the Culture Club.
There you go. Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Well, let's hear kind of the signature song from the album. This is Karma Chameleon.
You're a missed opportunity for learning. A comma chameleon could be a way of learning grammar and punctuation.
Oh, yeah.
That's what people, like a lot of people thought it was karma chameleon when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Because karma was not a concept that I had yet grasped.
Yeah. I thought it was karma comedian. It was like, what's the deal with karma?
Oh, God.
Anyway, so that was co-written actually with keyboardist Phil Pickett, who often played with the band. Boy George has explained that the song is about the fear of alienation and the tendency to try to please everyone rather than standing up for one's beliefs. The metaphor of a karma chameleon represents somebody who changes their personality to fit in rather than being true to themselves. And that seems like an overall theme to the album, but it's just this catchy, upbeat melody. You've got the harmonica actually played by Judd Lander. Just syrupy pop.
Yes, but with a soul singer sort of vibe to it too, with the kind of new wave synthy sound and reggae sounds in it, but also just Boy George looking the way he did then, with the makeup and the braided hair, and at that period that was very challenging for a lot of America to accept. So this album being as big as it was, the character that Boy George was sort of putting out there at the time, pretty much, at least for me as a little kid, that's the first time I was aware of someone being gay. And like being upfront about it in entertainment. And so that always really stuck with me that he was very, very brave.
Yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, unlike Bowie and other kind of glam rock artists, it wasn't, I get the sense that it wasn't really for show or to shock people. Right. I think it was more about what he was comfortable doing.
Yeah.
So I guess some members of the band didn't love the song at first because they thought it sounded like a country song.
I guess it had some, I would say, more like folky feel to it, especially when it came from Europe, these sort of elemental, European folk sounds coming through, and a lot of that second wave of British bands coming through in the 80s.
But again, the lyric Karma Chameleon is just kind of weird and interesting, for something that's so poppy. It's a little deep. A little thoughtful, I guess. Yeah. All right, well, let's hear one of the deeper album cuts. This is Changing Every Day.
Burt Bacharach going on there.
Yeah. I guess I was struck by how kind of R&B and soulful this album is.
Yeah, it is surprisingly soulful when you get past some of those singles.
Yeah, they actually have, I think something in common with like Simply Red.
Yeah.
So Changing Every Day, the lyrics deal with societal expectations, personal struggles, survival and adaptation, and of course, constant change. It's not a concept album, I don't think, but I think that those are recurring themes on this record. So my clickbait headline for Color by Numbers is Culture Club polishes human struggle with a bright, soulful pop sheen. So, you know, I think, you know, why I haven't gravitated to this in the past, even though, you know, I tend to like that British new wave scene, you know, it was just maybe a little too bright and poppy and probably, you know, more soulful than what I was used to. But, you know, this is in that new romantic movement that included Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet.
Yeah.
You know, some of those groups were sort of more informed by R&B. You know, I would say Spandau Ballet and ABC.
Sure.
Even Yaz had more of an R&B vibe.
And Duran Duran walked the line of being a little more hard rock.
Yeah.
Because of the guitar and bass sounds, really. And the machismo that existed behind a lot of the lyrics.
Yeah.
Which those other bands were a little more about romance, and Duran Duran felt more about checking out models.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and I think Duran Duran, maybe you could kind of trace back to punk rock. You know, there's a little bit more of that in it than this.
Yeah.
I don't hear any punk on this, although visually, you know, it has elements of it. But yeah, you know, again, as I said before, just bright pop songs with just a little more going on, which I really appreciate. It's a reason I like groups like Erasure and Pet Shop Boys, yes. You know, because there's always just a little more going on. Well, let's hear another big cut. This is Church of the Poison Mind.
So that was the lead single for the album. And definitely gospel-y,
yeah.
Motown-inspired pop soul track with a lot of brass and harmonica and then those powerful backing vocals from Helen Terry. I read that there's a strong influence from Stevie Wonder's song Uptight, Everything is All Right. I hear that. The kind of jangly rhythm section in particular. The lyrics explore themes of emotional manipulation, unrequited love, inner conflict, and the poison mind, symbolizing a toxic relationship or mindset. And the metaphor that's this corrupted church offering no safety, no sanctuary to those that are grappling with these human situations. And it's just so not what you expect.
Yeah.
You know, from a band like this. And I just always really enjoyed that song. And the term Church of the Poison Mind just was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know. So my clickbait headline to describe the album, Color by Numbers blends genre-defying grooves for the ultimate 80s vibe and unpoisons your mind.
Are some grooves.
Yeah. You know, and for me, like I said earlier, Boy George and Culture Club existing as they did and presenting as they did, I remember my mom loved how they sounded, but struggled with the look. Mm. She got over it. But, you know, at least for me, it did start to make me think, you know, if people do things different than me, I'm not going to hate them for it, you know?
Yep.
Just a little tap on the shoulder, nothing like mind-blowing, but it did start to clue me into a world of different kinds of people.
So I guess, you know, some of the, you know, relationship-based songs, you know, might have related to the relationship Boy George had with drummer John Moss. Mm. But some of the other highlights on the album for me, I really like that track, That's the Way, I'm Only Trying to Help You. I mean, that's like pure gospel, I think. And of course, like Helen Terry, you know, really shines on that one. There's the other, you know, big hits on the record, Miss Me Blind.
Love that song.
Yeah, cool. Like interesting guitar solo on there as well.
I remember really liking, again, the stuff you think as a kid, the way that he would say, blind, you know. It's just a stupid way to stretch out a word, but I remember liking that.
Yeah, he really is quite a singer, you know? I mean, he has like a smooth delivery, but he, like you said, like the affect on his voice, the inflections.
It's cool. And it's not overdone. There's not a lot of runs or there's not like, it's not like that, but cool little ways of mixing it up. It's a Miracle. That's a great one too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, very celebratory feel throughout many of these songs, which is very 84, you know?
Yes. Yeah, and then the album ends with that track Victims. I guess it's more like a traditional ballad, you know, maybe a little more bombastic.
Mr. Bombastic.
But yeah, you know, I'm happy that we spent time with this record because I think it's a gem. You know, it sounds great. I don't know. I guess over the years, if it were playing in my car or something, I might be embarrassed, you know, because it sounds like bubblegum, but it's more than bubblegum, I think. Yeah, so for a fun but thoughtful pop record, check out Culture Club, Color by Numbers.
All right, before we answer Don's deep question, why don't we hear from our friends over at the Abandoned Albums podcast.
Our mission at Abandoned Albums is simple. As simple as this ad. Our only goal is to keep the recorded work of artists on the cultural radar and showcase new artists who should be on the cultural radar. Some things in life are truly that simple. With our tongue firmly in cheek, it's why we say Abandoned Albums is the only music podcast that matters.
Ouch.
And it's available wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
We matter too. But yeah, definitely go check that one out. Even though it sounds scary, it isn't.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
So it's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we're talking about the year 1984. And of course, you and I were both youngsters at that time.
Yeah, elementary school age, yeah.
So, you know, children tend to do dumb things. And, you know, I was curious, what's something dumb you did in 1984?
Oh, God. Oh, it's a long list. It was a year we were living in a little town of like 5,000 people in the Midwest. And I got into some shit. And crazy stuff happened. So the craziest thing probably, and the more disrespectful than dumb, but we lived in an apartment complex, and there was a couple that lived next door, and that it was a Saturday. That day, the couple was, they were probably in their 30s. They were sunbathing on their car, on the hood of their car, and making out and stuff, and I was very uncomfortable. But then the next morning, parents told me that the cops had knocked on the door because apparently the husband had smothered the wife that night and killed her, which is terrible and scary and weird in a little town like that. But it did draw news crews, and there was a crime scene tape on the apartment right next door. And as the news crews were out there, me and my buddies were doing bike tricks in front of the such an ass move in front of the apartment to try and get on TV, which of course we did. But, you know, it's just kids are so selfish and insensitive to.
That was exciting stuff to have a news crew next door.
Yeah, but someone had died, man. And that was also the year that I wanted a pocket knife really bad. And my parents said no. I was riding, you know, me and my friends rode our bikes downtown and went to a hardware store, and I didn't have enough for one, but I did have enough for an 80-cent steak knife with a cardboard sleeve thing to protect the blade, and I carried that.
Pull it out, whip it out of the sleeve and say, what'd you say, Puck?
Yeah. Oh, boy. What a dummy.
Well, mine's not as good as that, and this... I guess the only dumb part of it was, you know, me wearing a scarf. We used to have this St. Bernard.
Was his name Beethoven?
No, his name was Moose, actually.
Oh, that's good. That's
but good he was like 160 pounds, and I was like 7 or 8 at the time. But you're out in the middle of winter, and as I said, I was wearing a scarf. And so just all of a sudden, he just started pulling on my scarf, as dogs do.
Oh, God.
And within a few seconds, he was actually dragging me around the yard by my neck by the scarf.
That sounds like a scene from Beethoven.
Yeah, I think they stole it from me. Well, what are some dumb things you did as a child or in the year 1984? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
I hinted at this at the end of the last episode. Seemed pretty straightforward to go with the album 1984 by Van Halen from 1984. Van Halen is a legendary rock band formed in 1972 in Pasadena, California. Eddie and Alex Van Halen, David Lee Roth, and Michael Anthony are the classic lineup, and this was the last time that lineup recorded together. Known for their energetic performances, innovative sound, Eddie Van Halen's guitar work, and they achieved massive commercial success through the late 70s to the 80s, and 84 was probably the biggest. You know, that album was probably their biggest. This is their sixth studio album, released January 9th of 1984. It was a big success. It hit number 2 on the Billboard 200, where it remained for 5 weeks, held back by Michael Jackson's Thriller, as we kind of talked about at the top. So why don't we jump in with Jump. Very iconic song featuring that distinctive synthesizer riff. Departure from the band's earlier guitar-driven sound, although they did play with synth on some of the earlier albums, including Women and Children First, where there were some sounds there, but this is where it was featured heavily for the first time. It also caused controversy in the band. David Lee Roth didn't like that poppy sound.
Which is funny, because his that early solo EP was very pop.
And, I know. Yeah. He was proven wrong, so then he leaned into it. But the song is in the key of D major, and has a fast tempo, approximately 130 beats per minute. Yeah, so everyone knows that song. It's supposedly about empowerment and encouragement to take risks. The recurring phrase jump being jump in and take a leap of faith, right? Don't be afraid. Go try. And maybe that was a lyrical buildup for David Lee Roth himself to jump into a solo career. I don't know.
Yeah, I always like the line, you got to roll with the punches and get to what's real. Is it what's real? Yeah.
Yeah.
That opening riff. It's almost like Baba O'Reilly, I think, with just having that sort of, I don't know, just kind of picks you up. I remember back to elementary school, you know, some assembly where some guy was doing like instrument demonstrations and he had the synthesizer up there and all of a sudden he did, and everybody's like, wow.
Yeah. And everyone went nuts. I remember having jump contests. Oh, yeah. Trying to jump like David Lee Roth. And that was probably the first time that I really embraced a harder rock type of thing, because it was poppy in a way, and it seemed less dangerous, even though he was dressed like a buffoon in the video and jumping around. Yeah, it was a cultural thing too, and MTV certainly didn't hurt.
I think, Danielson stole his jump, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, the crane kick. Yeah, that was close. However, the crane kick took all that build up, you know? David Lee Roth just jumped into it. All right, so why don't we listen to another one of the big hits off this one, Hot for Teacher. Now, one of the quintessential Van Halen tracks, playful lyrics, humorous story of infatuation with a school teacher, combining all the youthful exuberance and lots of double entendres, but a little controversy with the video. I mean, these are 30-year-old guys in a classroom setting, and teachers are dancing around on the desks.
And you have, like, the little boys are, like, acting like they're at a strip club.
Yeah. So, you know, and then there was the little dance routine that they did with the tuxedos. That was funny. One of the things that always drew me to this song was that Alex Van Halen, like, he could have been on the greatest drummers list when we were talking about them. This intro drum portion on the song where I always thought it sounded like an idling motorcycle.
Yeah.
It's just amazing the speed and precision that he has on that intro as well as throughout the song. So that's I wanted to make sure I mentioned that.
Yeah, and that's I assume that's like a double bass or like a double kick drum thing going there. I always wondered why drummers sometimes have the two kick drums, and I think that's why.
He also did have quite a rig with a lot of electronic pads. Drum pads too, so I'm not sure where all that was coming from, but it was really cool. My clickbait headline to describe 1984: David Lee Roth versus synth, the feud that rocked Van Halen's 1984. Who knew keyboards could cause such drama? And they also caused this to cross over enough that Van Halen stopped being like on the fringes and just being a rock fan's favorite band, but a lot of people got into them because of this.
I think MTV helped a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those three videos were just on all the time.
Yeah. The songs range from party anthems to reflective songs, you know, but there's a lot of party throughout. But yeah, I mean, Eddie Van Halen was at an all-time high of coolness in my eyes because, you know, did the guitar solo on Beat It. So they couldn't do any wrong in my eyes back when I was a kid.
He was dating the girl from One Day at a Time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Valerie Bertinelli. But the recording process for this was notably longer. They did it in the 5150 studios, and they had Eddie Van Halen had more control over it, which I think is probably part of the breakdown between the powers within the band of like, now we're in your home studio doing it your way. But he was right. I mean, it worked. And then, of course, that album cover created by Margot Nahas, depicting a cherub stealing cigarettes and smoking. It was banned, censored in the UK. And then the back cover is so weird because it's like all digital and modern. I think it's a nod to 1984, the George Orwell stuff. But the artwork doesn't really make any sense, but it's still iconic.
And even I think the 1984 is in like Roman numerals, isn't it? So you wouldn't even know what it was.
All right, so why don't we jump into one of the more, I guess, grown-up songs on the album. This one's called I'll Wait.
So another song that utilizes heavy synthesizer. I think it's probably overstated to what extent this album is like a synth album, because it's really just those two tracks, I think, Jump and I'll Wait, that really utilize it. Plus that intro, the 1984 instrumental.
Yeah, but this song sounds kind of like Journey or something at the time.
It does. Yeah, I think that's what's great about the way Eddie did it. Synthesizers were used to sound kind of like space age or whatever, or kind of moody or whatever, usually like kind of replacing strings. Mm-hmm. But here, it's taking the place of the guitar, and somehow it sounds just as rockin' and just as edgy as a guitar, I think. And I think he, deliberately chose sort of that brass sounding synth. I guess even the bass line on that track is also a synthesizer. So you got Michael Anthony playing some keyboard bass.
Cool.
But I'll Wait, the lyrics were supposedly inspired by, I guess, David Lee Roth had seen this Calvin Klein men's underwear advertisement that actually had a young lady wearing men's underwear. And so he pinned it next to his television or something and wrote the lyrics to it. Which is
okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's
whatever works for you, Dave. Yeah.
So my clickbait headline for 1984 is Van Halen version 1 ends with hard pop bang. If Van Halen had just ended then, right, if they hadn't moved on with Hagar, I think this would have been perfect, because I think, the first album is fantastic.
It's just guitar shreddery.
Yeah. And so, and then to end with this, I think that would have been just a fantastic career. But of course, they moved on and did more good things.
They did record an album with Roth again in the early 2000s.
Was missing Michael Anthony.
Yeah, no Michael Anthony. It was Wolfgang Van Halen on bass. A Different Kind of Truth was the name of the album.
So yeah, this was not something that appealed to me all that much back in the day, but I've really become a Van Halen fan over the years.
Cool.
You talked about Alex Van Halen's drumming. It was just so hard. Everything, he's just pounding. Mm-hmm. And there's just like every Van Halen song, even the slightly quieter ones, still have like just this driving pulse that's amazing. And of course, Eddie's great. And Roth is, he's a rock and roll front man, and he sort of embodies the stereotypical rock and roll lifestyle, just this kind of crazy goofball that gets the ladies. And
yeah, he is. He is a goof. A couple fun facts. The song Top Jimmy, which keeps getting stuck in my head, even though it's not like my favorite song, it's inspired by a guy named James Konkak, who was the front man of Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, who David Lee Roth was friends with. And Top Jimmy, his nickname, he got it while working at the Top Taco Stand outside of A&M Records in Hollywood.
Nice.
Just so weird. Like, I thought Top Jimmy was maybe about like Jimmy Page or Jimi Hendrix, like a great guitar player, but it's about this dude.
So. That's a cool song. The guitar part, particularly at the beginning, is kind of interesting and not typical Eddie, I think.
Yeah, I guess it was an instrumental that Roth put this on top of. Some of the other album highlights, of course, Panama.
Yeah, it's
guitar riff, crazy.
I feel like Panama could have been on the first album.
Yeah. Yeah, it has that classic Van Halen sound. Drop Dead Legs, that bluesy, sultry vibe with a great guitar riff.
Girl Gone Bad was I think I ordered that video from TV. Just kidding.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Girl Gone Bad's good. Actually, those are the last two tracks on the album, Girl Gone Bad and House of Pain.
Yeah.
Side two's pretty good.
House of Pain sounds kind of like a early 80s Kiss song to me.
Yeah. I'll buy that.
Kind of a little heavier throughout. I like that track a lot. It's a really good closer. And I wonder if the rap group House of Pain got their got the inspiration for their name there. All right, so Van Halen's 1984 stands out as a defining album of its era, blending all those sounds that we talked about, released in the same year as records like Princess Purple Rain, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. It cemented its place in a pivotal year for pop and rock music and ushered in an era where David Lee Roth could scat to his heart's content.
Boozy, boozy, bop.
So go check out Van Halen's 1984.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Yeah, so it's been a fun week exploring, I guess, both the harder and the lighter sides of 1984. But what have you been digging lately?
Now, I might have missed this one if it weren't for Don letting me know about it. Hours, a band we've talked about on the show. Now it's Hours starring Jimmy Necco, but Jimmy Necco's the lead singer. It's called New Age Heroin, just came out this month. I got confused because there was an album called New Age Heroin 2 in 2018 Jesus. By Hours. So I would have probably ignored it thinking it was the same thing. They're an American rock band known for atmospheric, emotional sound, alternative rock, and lots of introspective soul-shredding lyrics. Jimmy Necco is recognized for his powerful, dynamic vocals. Why don't we listen to a little bit of Eternally? It might be the seventh studio album. It got a little dicey after they stopped being on major labels. But this one's a little more musically stripped down than some of the others. A little overblown. The Voice is the star. Yeah, it's a great album for Rainy Fall Days. Any of their albums. His vocal sound is just good for a melancholy day. So check out New Age Heroin.
I wonder if we could get him on the show.
Maybe. He'd probably remember from when we met us.
Oh, I'm sure.
Multiple times. And then the next one I'm going to mention is The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. That's the name of the performer as well as the album. It's a groundbreaking 1968 album blending psychedelic rock, operatic vocals, and theatrical elements. Best known for its fiery hit, Fire. Why don't we listen to a little bit of that? So Arthur Brown is an eccentric British musician known for those theatrical performances and pioneering influence in psychedelic rock and shock rock, especially through that persona he had as the God of Hellfire.
Jeez, I feel like the vinyl would melt.
Yes, well, I have it on CD as well as picked up a copy of it on vinyl. It is a UK pressing from 1968, but yeah, the style is categorized on Discogs as psychedelic rock and horror rock. I'm not sure if I'd take it that far, but it's fascinating. Listen, this guy is kooky, and you can really hear a lot of what he was doing, influencing music to come. That the way that he was singing kind of influenced, I think, how heavy metal vocals evolved. So go check out The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. What you digging, buddy?
Well, one that came out sort of without me knowing, Midland. Right? You probably like these guys too, right?
I love them, but I missed it.
Yeah, so Midland has a new album called Barely Blue. It's the fifth studio album by the band formed in Dripping Springs, Texas. Guess who produced it?
I want to say the super producer of all things country and blues rock. Dave Cobb.
Yep, it is in fact Dave Cobb. This is their first time working with him. I've only listened through a couple of times, but sounds really good. They call it an 8-song exploration of loneliness, masculinity, and resilience in the face of heartache. That's kind of what, you know, rootsy country is all about, I think. Here's a track called Vegas.
Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas.
Wait, Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas? No. That's an eye-opening realization right there. But yeah, they sound great. I wish there were more country bands. I wish there were just more bands in general out there instead of all these solo artists. But I've enjoyed their records all the way along, so I'll definitely check that one out.
Okay, and I just recently had the pleasure of seeing the band Keen, who's on they're calling it their 20th anniversary tour for their debut album, Hopes and Fears. So I've been listening to that album a lot. So here's one of my favorite cuts on the album, Can't Stop Now. I've got troubles of
my own, 'cause I'm sure. Yeah, I remember that one. I think I had this CD back in 2004, but yeah. It disappeared somewhere over the years.
A lot of people had this album. You know, their first two albums did really well, and I mean, they're still going. They've come out with like 5 albums. The whole catalog is really solid, but great place to start is with their debut album, Hopes and Fears. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
it will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show when I'm reminded of the passage from George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
I'm feeling very strong.
Me too. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, the Wheel of a Musical Discovery, and see what we'll be discovering next week.
Sometimes, an album carries one primary feeling or emotion throughout the listening experience. Next time, you will be exploring angry albums. Try not to break anything.
That's interesting. Yeah. So we're just focusing on anger, huh? Looking for albums that exhibit that. Well, it's probably going to get metally up in here, at least a little bit.
Yeah, I'm usually more of a depression and melancholia.
I hope that this anger doesn't spill into our personal relationships in this upcoming week. Don't forget, you can suggest topics for The Wheel on our website, albumnerds.com, as well as vote on any ongoing Album Nerds Hall of Fame nominations.
Well, what's your favorite angry album? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you for joining us here on the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next time with a little anger, but we'll still love you.
Class dismissed!
Just don't have that presence that David Lee Roth has.
Yeah, I give you 57%.